This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Earth is a hot mess, literally, and we made it that way. Thankfully, more of us are taking responsibility for cleaning it up for our sake and for the sake of our ecosystem. Many of you told us you've already taken steps to own this challenge as much as you can.
We took some of our retirement money and put solar panels on the roof of our house.
I made the decision to cut out meat from my diet.
My husband and I have quit using our clothes dryer.
I walk to work every day.
I drive a Leaf all-electric vehicle.
Always making sure I'm bringing water with me, not buying single-use plastic.
I ride my bike and take public transportation.
I have prairie planted on my property. I love watching all the pollinators, all the critters that come and go.
Now, all that's great to hear, but is it enough? The latest word from the UN is that 1 million species are at risk of extinction because of what we have done to this planet. Its report says we can turn this around, but will we? What would it take to really save the Earth, save these species, and save ourselves? Joining us in studio is Thomas Lovejoy. He's a biology professor at George Mason University and a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation. Professor Lovejoy, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here.
Also with us in studio is Susan Casey Lefkowitz, the chief program officer at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Susan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts on the UN report or on what can be done to reverse the extinction of these species. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Lovejoy, let me start with you and a term that will come up quite a bit through this conversation and that came up in the report. The term came up in the comments from British scientist Robert Watson, who headed the report. Here's part of what he said.
We're losing species at a historical rate. Potentially 500,000 to a million species are threatened with loss. We've lost much of our native forest, much of our native wetlands, and effectively, biodiversity needs to be considered as an equally important issue as climate change.
That's Robert Watson, who headed the report. There's that term biodiversity. What exactly is biodiversity, and why does it matter?
So it's a collective term for the variety of life on Earth, and all of that supports humanity in various ways, gives us benefits, and it's a pretty serious issue.
Give me an example of what one of those benefits might be, especially for, say, a species that I've never heard of, never seen, don't even know about, but that's part of the ecosystem.
Well, you know, maybe a whole bunch of species I can't even give you the names of, which live in the New York City watershed, provide New York City citizens clean, wonderful water every day. Or it might be a bacterium in a Yellowstone hot spring, which makes certain biochemical reactions work that have transformed diagnostic medicine.
Susan, the report outlines 5 ways that humans are reducing this biodiversity, contributing to habitat loss, burning fossil fuels, polluting land and water, bringing invasive species into new areas, and overfishing. Those are the 5 factors that the report outlines that are reducing biodiversity. Give me your sense of those and whether there are any that stand out the most to you, whether they're all equally concerning. How do you see them?
So one thing about these 5 factors is that they're all interrelated. So in part, what we're looking at is the effects that build up through each of these pressures on our natural systems and on the wildlife that lives there. But the one that I'd maybe pull out is fossil fuels, in part because climate change itself, which is caused by fossil fuels, is also a major driver of the kind of threat that we're seeing to our natural systems.
Was there anything in particular, Susan, in this report that surprised you, that prompted a strong reaction from you, especially because you've been involved in environmental policy and conservation for decades? What stood out to you the most within this report?
So what really struck me in this report was seeing all of this information in one place, collected by, you know, the highest regarded scientists from all around the world. We've never had such a wake-up call when it comes to the need to protect our biodiversity, our natural systems, our wildlife.
Professor, what about you? Anything in this report that surprised you or that provoked a reaction from you?
Well, there was no surprise at all in the report, but I'm just really grateful that the international process finally came together to do that kind of study and grab the attention of the planet.
Is this kind of an international process kind of unprecedented? I mean, is this, Professor, is this the first time that this scope of a study has been done?
It's the first time it's been done at an international level. So the Climate Change Convention has its own scientific body, which has been doing this periodically. This is the first time it's ever been done for biodiversity by that kind of international process.
Now, Professor, back in 1980, you published the first estimate of global extinction rates in the Global 2000 report that was submitted to then-President Jimmy Carter. Remind us of what the main takeaways of that report were.
So at that point, climate change was pretty much just on the horizon, and the greater concerns were about habitat destruction and the other kinds of things we do that affect biological diversity. And it was really interesting that the projection was quite similar to what comes out of this report. And the reason that it was wrong in terms of the date was because people began to react and take corrective action. So that's a real note of hope.
So the report came out in 1980. It was pegged kind of aiming at the year 2000, but that deadline kind of put some fear in people and made them act?
That's right. So the amount of protected areas in the world increased dramatically since then, nowhere near where it needs to have happened. But then climate change came thundering up on the horizon.
Susan, what's your sense of when we began to actually think about extinction per se? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, wetlands could be destroyed, or we could have more acid rain, or there could be more pollution. But the idea of species disappearing, including species we may not even know exist, how long has that kind of been with us as a threat?
Well, I think for the scientific community, it's been there as a threat for quite a long time. You know, for individual people, though, I think that you might think more about the great wildlife of Africa, right? Like a giraffe or an elephant or tigers. What this report is underlining is that it's everything from the smallest insects and birds to some of the largest marine mammals in the oceans that are under threat. It's things that we see every day in our backyards. It's things that live in the streams and the bays that we love. So this is a report that really brings it to our homes, to our communities, the kinds of impacts that extinction could be having in the near future if we don't take action.
We're speaking to Susan Casey Lefkowitz, Chief Program Officer at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and biology professor Thomas Lovejoy of George Mason University, also a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation. Glad to get some of your comments on this. Brian emailed, "Perhaps we would be wise to remember we are part of nature, not separate from it. We have the unique ability to manipulate nature, but as with any other animal, we are too often guided by short-term greed and tend to take all we can get. Nature is a system operating in balance. Things that upset the balance do so at their own risk. We, and only we, are responsible for our actions." Professor Lovejoy, I'd like your response to what Brian said, particularly the comment about we, as with any other animal, are too often guided by short-term greed. I get the sense from reading some of these reports that other animals may be smarter than us in terms of the way that they exist in equilibrium with their ecosystem, whereas we just kind of find more technological ways to kind of take all we can get.
Well, we're particularly talented at doing it compared to other species. It's not unique to us, but we spend most of our time almost like a bunch of baboons mutually grooming and ignoring the environmental lion that's creeping up.
Susan, what about the rate of species loss? The UN report found that it's accelerating at a rate that's unprecedented. What's changed since the 80s to now to drive that acceleration?
I think a lot of what's changed is the types of pressures that we're putting on our natural systems. You know, we've been continuing to log the Great Boreal Forest of Canada for toilet paper. We've been continuing to overfish our oceans. We've been continuing to use pesticides on our fields that are poisoning our bees and our butterflies. And then, as Dr. Lovejoy said, in addition, we're also looking at the increasing pressures of climate change, which we know is happening right now at home in the United States and all around the world.
I wonder how you view that, Susan, particularly because, you know, and we'll talk about policy options and solutions in just a little bit, but, you know, I can imagine there are people who are totally sympathetic with the need to not overlog forests in Canada. They also like having toilet paper. So there's this kind of tension there. Like, are you asking me to stop using, to use less toilet paper? Like, it seems like we've reached a point where the creature comforts we're used to almost make it impossible to unwind some of the things that we've done, at least practically.
Well, and I think that the note of hope that's in this report and in what we've seen in practice is that we do have the solutions to have the creature comforts that we're used to have strong and healthy communities to live in, to have good jobs, and to protect our natural systems. It's as the earlier questioner said, we have the capacity to live in balance with nature, and we just haven't made the political decisions to do that yet.
We want to talk about some of those political decisions when we continue with Susan Casey Lefkowitz and Professor Thomas Lovejoy. Glad to hear about some of the decisions that many of y'all are making. Gail wrote on our Facebook page, I don't use plastic produce bags. I use as many biodegradable products as I can. I buy and consume as few disposable products as I can. I drive a hybrid car and walk or bike when I can. I do these things not knowing if what I do makes a real difference to the massive problem humans have caused to all life on the planet. I do them because I don't want to make the problem worse. Well, good for you, Gail, but I do want to get into how much we really can do, whether these are just things that make ourselves feel better, whether they're making an impact, or whether larger solutions are needed. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the new UN report on climate change and biodiversity with Professor Thomas Lovejoy of George Mason University and Susan Casey Lefkowitz of the National Natural Resources Defense Council. Earlier, we shared some of the ways that you have changed your lifestyles to address climate change. Here's more of what you had to say.
I reduced my personal footprint by composting everything that I possibly can.
When we had our current home built, we opted for a ground source heat pump for our heating and cooling.
I also have a 2,500-gallon rainwater collection system.
Trying not to buy brand new, I purchase secondhand.
What we would like to do is transition that land from growing corn and soybeans to putting it into agroforestry or permaculture crops, something that is much more diverse.
I've decided not to have children. I don't want my children to create an even greater mess than humans have already caused.
Thanks to those of you who left messages for us, and we welcome more of your thoughts in terms of what you've changed or what questions you have about this report, about extinctions, about the outlook, and about what can be done. Or if there are certain things that you are unwilling to do, knowing what the problem is, where do you draw the line in terms of the impact you're willing to have, in terms of the changes or concessions or sacrifices that you're willing to make? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before I bring one more voice into the conversation, Professor, let's back up to the number in this report about a million species going extinct. Can you break that down a little bit more, particularly because I'm sure there are species out there that we don't even know are out there. So can you just pick apart that 1 million species figure a bit?
So there are about 8 million estimated species, only 1.3 million described by science. So we've done a pretty poor job of that. But we've basically described the more obvious things, animals, vertebrates like ourselves, a lot of plants. And so we're basically looking at something on the order of 10-15% of all of that being close to extinction.
So this is basically a million that we know of that could go extinct, potentially many, many more that we will never get a chance to know.
Yeah, and I'm sure that number includes undescribed species. Right? I mean, the soil is full of biological diversity. That's why it's fertile. But we have explored it very poorly.
Susan, I don't think I gave you a chance to answer the earlier question in terms of the impact of these species disappearing, particularly if it's a species that I've never heard of, never knew about, that's never been cataloged. How do you see some of the potential impacts of this mass extinction on us?
Yeah. Well, you know, one is that, of course, nature, our natural systems, species, they have an intrinsic value all for themselves. But the other is that we really depend on them as humans. So loss of species, loss of natural systems, it's going to affect our food security. It's going to affect our ability to withstand the impacts of climate change. There's a lot of ways that we depend on species and on natural systems that we barely even are aware of. So it's going to have a big impact on the way that we live.
How do you see the evolution, Susan, of our understanding of that point? I feel like we're better equipped now than we were decades ago to understand, like, oh, just because I can't see a species doesn't mean it doesn't matter. And especially depending on what part of the country you're from. Like, I grew up in South Florida, so I learned a lot about coral reefs, both as a source of biodiversity and as a bulwark against hurricanes. So it was super important to us. But how do you see that evolution over time of just that awareness?
I think it's starting to increase, but I think that there's a lot that people are still not aware of. So, for example, there's a great increase in awareness around the importance of pollinators. You know, looking at our butterflies and our bees, we know that they are declining very rapidly. We know that it's caused by pesticides. So we know that it's something that we can reverse and change. And we know how connected they are to our food systems.
We did an hour, by the way, last year about what would happen as honeybees continue to be threatened around the world. You can find that online at the1a.org. I think we gave it one of our better titles for any program. We called it Pollinator Judgment Day. I like that one. You'll find that online at the1a.org. Joel emailed, "We absolutely need to turn the conversation to the politics. What policies should we enact to fix this? What are the hard choices to make? What are the sacrifices that need to be made? Who will benefit and who stands to lose from those policies? This is the hard part. It's the biggest hurdle because people will disagree, but that is why we have politics." Well said, Joel, and that is a good place to add another voice to the conversation. Here with us in studio, back with us in studio, is Amy Harder, who covers energy and climate for Axios. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about the politics, particularly the response, if any, from the Trump administration. Have we heard anything from the administration in response to this report?
They've been very muted on this report. And of course, on climate change, they are rolling back everything that the last administration did. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was just in the Arctic and really didn't address climate change as a problem at all. And so I think ignoring this report falls in line with what the administration has done with all reports on environmental and climate issues, including ones that they issued on climate change.
I'm glad you brought up the Secretary of State. I want to play a clip from what he said. He addressed some of the effects of climate change without using the term climate change. Here's part of what the Secretary said yesterday.
Steady reductions in sea ice are opening new passageways and new opportunities for trade. This could potentially slash the time it takes to travel between Asia and the West by as much as 20 days. Arctic sea lanes could come before the 21st century Suez and Panama canals.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking yesterday at a meeting with the Arctic Council in Finland. Can I just read back the beginning of that clip? Steady reductions in sea ice are opening new passageways and new opportunities for trade. It kind of sounds like he's saying that climate change can be good business. Am I hearing him wrong?
No, that's exactly what I think he's saying. And in a vacuum, he's technically right on that. But what he's ignoring is the much bigger problem that a warming Arctic poses. It's warming at a much faster rate than the rest of the planet. And it's sort of a canary in the coal mine for what the rest of the world is going to face. So I think it came pretty shocking to a lot of people to hear the administration imply that climate change is real, but only in a way that benefits people. The negative impacts of a warming world are going to outweigh the positive impacts of a warming world. To be clear, those exist in some parts of the world for a certain amount of time. Colder areas will be better for farming for several decades. But by and large, scientists say, and I'm sure the guests with us today would agree, that the negative effects far outweigh the positive effects. And so to only talk about the minority positive effects ignores ignores the bigger problem.
And Professor Lovejoy, if I could ask you to chime in on that too, you would know about this better than I would, but it occurs to me, if the sea ice is receding, that might open passageways for trade. But if the Earth is warming, that means the waterways over the Earth are warming, which increases the potential for severe weather and stronger storms that makes it impossible to ship things in the first place.
So the warmer the world is, the more energy there is to go into cyclones and other severe weather events. But, you know, the other thing is the last time the planet was 2 degrees warmer, the oceans were 4 to 6 meters higher. And I don't think you need to know anything more than that to know that that's not a bright idea.
Amy, let's talk more about the administration. It has gone to some pains in certain situations to really push back action and research on climate change, including just playing with some of the terminology and reports. How does this report from the UN stack up against what the administration's been doing, policy-wise?
I think this UN report, since it was a United Nations report separate from the administration, it hasn't elicited such an aggressive response from the administration compared to, say, the National Climate Assessment, which was issued by the Trump administration with little fanfare. I think one version was issued on Black Friday after Thanksgiving, which is a common day that news is often dumped if you want to not have it covered a lot. Of course, that didn't happen. It was covered a lot. But I think we're seeing a very split screen dynamic with the administration on climate change. And I think the vast majority of people see official comments from the president on Twitter and other places dismissing it as an issue. If you look a little bit closer, you see that they're not going after things like a 2009 scientific finding by the Environmental Protection Agency, which confirmed that greenhouse gases are endangering public health and welfare. If they would go after that, that would be a real sign of how aggressive this administration was looking to be. Now, that being said, all of their moves are incredibly aggressive, and I would say far more aggressive than a lot of conservatives who I spoke with right as Trump took office. They just assumed that climate change would make its way back into the lexicon of this administration in a more muted way. But in fact, that never happened.
Back to the Arctic Council, what was the reaction to what the Secretary of State said? Did he find any support in there? Did they kind of laugh it off? Like, what was the reaction like?
They were incredibly surprised, and some were disappointed and disgusted. I think the existence of this Arctic Council is not to address security concerns against China and otherwise, which is what Pompeo was focused on. Its mandate is largely about climate change. So to ignore it is really surprising to the people that are involved with it.
Susan, what is your sense in terms of policy-wise? We've got this UN report, right, that the world basically acknowledges this is the extant threat to human survival around the world. What is your sense of the impact of current U.S. policy under the Trump administration compared to how the rest of the world is dealing with this? Does the rest of the world just kind of say, okay, say what you want, we'll keep doing our thing? Or does the U.S. really have that center of gravity that affects the way the rest of the world deals with climate change?
So the U.S., as we all know, has not only been ignoring climate change, but it's actually been actively trying to undermine past policies to fight climate change and undermine our critical bedrock conservation goals. It's trying to open our oceans to drilling for oil and gas. It's trying to roll back monument and park protections. The rest of the world on climate change has done an excellent job at moving ahead despite the U.S. And this took some thought and work, but we've really seen countries like China and India, regions like Europe, step out as leaders and say, we are going to continue our commitments. And what our expectation is that they will do the same around these biodiversity issues, no matter where the U.S. current government tends to be.
Professor Lovejoy, what's your sense about how the world has been dealing with the research on climate change? You said that the report that came out in 1980 prompted some real action since 2000. It seems like the world has gotten better at working together in researching and thinking about these issues, at least from my perspective as a layman. But how do you see it?
Well, to bring it back to the report at hand, I think the big difference over time since 1980 has been growing awareness of the impacts of climate change. And basically, there's no place on the planet where you can't see the fingerprints of climate change on biological systems. And we're even seeing some beginning to fall apart, like tropical coral reefs or our coniferous forests, which now are being run by the bark beetles.
Is it? It seems like it's almost two different ways of looking at the problem. I don't know if you see it this way, but as we talk about it policy-wise, we talk about it either country to country or alliance to alliance or the whole world, like every country working together. But the Earth doesn't recognize geographic boundaries. So for you as a researcher, does that make it two different kinds of conversations? Like we have to adapt this global set of findings to national boundaries to get things done?
Well, one does need, you know, strong national commitments. And what's so encouraging actually in this country, despite the administration, is what's going on at the level of states and cities and in the corporate sector, which means that the U.S. will nonetheless meet its commitments under the Paris Agreement.
Interesting you bring that up, because one of our listeners, Longevity, tweeted, "We talk about fundamental policies to change this, but the current administration denies basic science, so the only way to combat this is state-by-state government mandates to be in accord with the Paris Climate Agreement." Susan?
And that was exactly the point that I was going to make. It's so important to recognize that I think one reason that the rest of the world is willing to move ahead despite the Trump administration is that our cities and states have really stepped up. They have shown the world very clearly that at that level, where a lot of the real action needs to take place, where a lot of the policies around, different types of transportation solutions, different types of building energy efficiency, different conservation goals, our cities and states are really stepping up to that challenge.
But Amy Harder, isn't there only so much that cities and states can do? I mean, there is a certain province for the federal government and there's a certain province for the states. I mean, that's the way the system was built. Even if all 50 states got together and did the exact same thing, it still wouldn't be quite the same as the United States government doing it, right?
Right. And there's two parts to that issue. One is from a substantive perspective, a lot of the states that have most of the emissions are actually not stepping up, right? Because they have a lot of the fossil fuels and they're resistant to action on this front. So just today, we reported about how there's a growing number of states and companies that are committing to deep reductions. And it's been a lot of action since Trump came into office. But even all of these added up, it's still only about 30 to 40% of U.S. emissions in the electricity sector. So we're still just talking about a sliver of the problem. And so from a numbers perspective, you need the federal government to act. But on a broader scale, from a symbolism perspective, this is, of course, a very global problem. And, success addressing climate change is really going to lie in places like Southeast Asia, where there's a huge demand for electricity, understandably so, where people are really doubling down on coal. And so the leadership of the American government is essential in those types of conversations, and those aren't happening right now.
Professor, one thing I forgot to ask you earlier, I'm sorry, with regards to the million species that are on this list from the report, humans are not on that list of the million, right? It's a million species other than human beings, right?
That's right.
Is that kind of part of the key? Susan, I wonder if that's what it takes to make change. I don't recall, at least, hearing a report, at least in recent years, saying we must do something about climate change or we will die. I hear the seas will rise. I hear we'll lose species. I hear there'll be more storms. You know, there will be parts of the land that will no longer be arable. I have yet to hear one international report, maybe you have, I have not, that says if we don't do something about this, you and your children and your neighbors and your country and everyone you love will die. Is that what it takes?
So the issue of what does it take to build political will is such an important one right now. And I feel as though we have been seeing a change when it comes to political will to take action on climate change. And that is happening because of the kinds of impacts that we're seeing. I guess I need to have hope and faith that in our world, we can build that kind of political will before we get to the point of human beings being on the brink of extinction. I would hope that as a species, we're smart enough that we can do better than that and take action sooner.
We'll continue in just a moment with Susan Casey Lefkowitz of the Natural Resources Defense Council, Professor Thomas Lovejoy of George Mason University, and Amy Harder, who covers energy and climate for Axios. Want to get to some more of your practical questions about what we can do and also get a sense of what we can do How much of this is in individual hands, and how much of this do we have to rely on governments for? Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Amy Harder, Professor Thomas Lovejoy, and Susan Casey Lefkowitz. Let's talk about what can be done to address the concerns that are in this UN report and hopefully prevent some extinctions, including our own. Let me begin with a comment from a listener that might throw a little cold water on the way that we pursue this. Deandra emailed, "The idea that the tiny things individuals do can make a difference on the grand scale of climate change is such a myth. Corporations and government set the tone. The government can force or incentivize green production and safe interactions with our environment. Corporations have complete control of how they package and produce goods. Don't make this about how long people shower or what people eat. It's a drop in the bucket." Let's split that into two parts, corporations and government. Amy, let's start with the government piece in terms of whether what we do is a drop in the bucket compared to not just the U.S. government, but governments in general.
I tend to agree with the listener that taken individually, what each of us does is a drop in the bucket. But it really is all connected. The way I cover this issue is that ultimately action will be needed by most governments in the world, with buy-in from corporations, because they're, for better or worse, an integral part of the way government policy is made. But the more people understand their environmental footprint, the more they get aware, and the more there'll be public awareness about the issue. And that bleeds into this conversation about pressure on governments and protests, and investors are starting to care more about it. And so all of this connects together. And so even though from a numbers perspective, what we do on an individual basis doesn't make a difference, I do think over time, as people think more about this, they'll become more involved, and then eventually that trickles up to the government. In this case, with this government, it's not going to resonate, but I do think ultimately there needs to be global multilateralism. And right now, the entire world is very down on multilateralism, which is why it's very difficult to make progress on climate change.
Yeah, international alliances are strained, to say the least, around the world for a variety of reasons. Susan, a number of the listeners brought up that one of their best ways to address climate change is voting. But I wonder what you see in terms of either movement on policy in Congress or rhetoric on the campaign trail, mostly among Democratic hopefuls that are seeking to unseat President Trump. What are you seeing?
So, first of all, I agree with Amy that it's all interconnected. You know, absolutely, people should continue to do everything they can at an individual level. But to really make a difference, we need their power, their voice, the voice of so many individuals putting pressure on our government leaders and on our corporations. And we are seeing a change. The U.S. House of Representatives flipped. We saw many more champions come into office for climate and for protection of our natural systems. And we see a very different dialogue, a very different conversation happening now at the federal level in our country, one that is taking climate change, taking environmental damage much more seriously.
Professor Lovejoy, it also seems like the governmental aspect of this can affect just the research itself. I mean, the report that came out in 1980 was submitted to a president. So it seems like the research community has a stake in this, too, because depending on the political climate, the research may or may not even get done to elucidate what the problem is.
So, and also you can get research done and sort of ignored for a while. But the responsible scientists will make sure that they keep going at it until it gets attention. And I think there are actually ways that we can make a difference as individuals, particularly in our diet. That can have major impacts, and also in empowering of women and affecting population growth in constructive ways. So it's got to be a continuum.
How do you see the role, Professor, of scientists in terms of the policy aspect of this? There's the mixed opinions, I think, depending on what kind of a researcher you are, in how much you want to get into the politics at all, because that can influence your ability to do your work. Whereas some scientists say, no, it's our responsibility to say, here's the data and here's the solution that the data points to. How do you see it?
So, you know, some scientists are uncomfortable about that. I've never actually had that difficulty. You know, when I'm a scientist, I'm doing my science in the usual kind of very self-critical kind of way. And then I step to one side and say, as a citizen, what does that science actually mean, and how should it inform policy? And I've never found any difficulty in knowing which foot I was on.
With regards to the impact of corporations, that reflects an email that we got from Emily. Here's what she left in our inbox.
My name is Emily. I'm calling from San Francisco. I am glad to hear that you are covering the latest report from the United Nations about the environment, but find myself frustrated that the first question was about what I do in my personal life to fix it. Personal responsibility environmentalism hasn't worked for the last many decades that we've tried it, and we need to move beyond blaming ourselves for this issue. 100 companies are responsible for 71% of global warming, and we know who these companies are.
Emily, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. And just by way of context, Emily is referencing a report that came out in 2017 that found that about 100 companies, including the Russian energy company Gazprom and ExxonMobil, produced 71% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And that was a measure from the late 80s to the mid-20-teens. Susan, how would you respond to that point that Emily's making?
Well, I think that she's absolutely right in terms of the need to focus on corporations, and especially when it comes to fossil fuel companies. You know, this is an industry sector that has not been willing to shift to cleaner forms of energy. They're very wedded to the fossil fuels that are their bread and butter. It's a wealthy sector. It's a powerful sector. And making sure that we are raising awareness about the kind of damage that fossil fuels do is a critical part of our next steps.
Amy?
The angle of corporations is something I focus on a lot because I do think they could unlock actual climate policy in the United States. I think you won't be able to get big climate policy through Congress without the big oil companies being on board, or at least not fighting it. Historically, the fossil fuel industry, in particular oil and gas, have been very resistant to any climate policy. There has been a pretty notable shift among some companies over the last 2 years to more readily acknowledge climate change. And that's not because they suddenly care about their planet. At the end of the day, it's about their profits and their bottom line and the pressure they're facing. They're under pressure from lawsuits, ExxonMobil in particular. Investors are urging them to do more. And so you're seeing shifts, particularly among the European oil companies like Royal Dutch Shell and Equinor, which even changed its name from Statoil. These companies are attempting a shift so they can make money in a world that's using far fewer fossil fuels. But at the end of the day, you know, these companies say that we still need to make a profit and the world still uses a heck of a lot of oil and gas. So that's their argument. But there is a shift, but it's very uneven. American oil companies are not as forward-thinking on that front.
That almost seems to bolster Emily's point, though. I mean, if nothing's going to happen in Congress until and unless oil energy companies in general are on board with it, then that kind of means that they hold the cards, right? Like me as a voter, I can yell and scream and call my member of Congress and show up on their and knock on their office door all I want. But unless I've got a business card that says, you know, Chevron on it, they could give a damn. Like, I don't have the power to do anything.
Right. And with this administration, even the big oil companies are not being that effective. The relationship between big oil, the companies like Exxon and Chevron, it's not that great of a relationship. Trump is more in tune with sort of the smaller oil and gas companies and the coal industry. And much of the coal industry is not nearly as outspoken about climate change because to them, there's really no future, sizable future for coal in a carbon-constrained world. Natural gas is poised to increase in the short term if there's big action on climate change. And so I think this is why I focus on it. And ultimately, I think it'll depend on if these companies see a carbon tax or some sort of policy as helping them financially. And I know that sounds a little bit, you know, crass or whatnot, but that's how our capitalism system works.
Professor Lovejoy, would you also chime in on Emily's point with regards to the role of corporations versus individuals in affecting the climate, protecting biodiversity, and so forth?
Well, since 70% of the world's economic product is in the private sector, you don't have a solution unless they're right in the forefront of it. And I think the fossil fuel companies may suddenly, sooner than we might believe, start going in a different direction when they realize they are likely to be valued as having stranded assets that they can't produce from. Or if they do a really wild choice and just really crank down on their production rates and send the price of fossil fuels soaring, they do just fine financially, right?
Although I do get the sense, Susan, that some of these companies are starting to kind of wake up to how insistent many people are to see something done. I mean, I just came back from Dallas and visited the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. Yes, that Perot, as in Ross Perot, his family. And there's a whole floor that has to do with energy production, with oil, natural gas, how it's drilled, and the way that the process goes, and how much cleaner it is, and how things are changing, and what the future of energy is. And on one hand, it can feel kind of like, oh, wow, an exhibit about oil and natural gas in a science museum that's funded by oil and natural gas companies. On the other hand, they're also trying really hard to rehabilitate their image because they know people are asking questions.
Well, one thing that's happened is that fossil fuels have lost their social license. There's not as much an assumption that oil is a good thing. In fact, I think most people now realize that it's something that is slowly destroying our planet. But the key here is also the tie-in between corporations and government regulation. So corporations are not just going to act of their own free will when it comes to taking better actions or changing their whole business plan. It's in part going to take government regulation to make sure that we have strong policies in place to really shift where we're getting our energy from. And of course, we have better solutions with energy efficiency and renewable energy. We know that we can chart a path forward that is not as dependent on fossil fuels.
I would note, by the way, we did spend some time in Greeley, Colorado, which is the heart of Colorado's oil and natural gas extraction country. And folks there expressed tremendous pride in not only the work that they do, but also the efforts of their industry, at least from their perspective, to get cleaner and more environmentally friendly. And you can find that coverage as part of 1A Across America online at the1a.org/AcrossAmerica. With regard to that drop in the bucket thing, Richard emailed, "My action is a drop in the bucket. 327.2 million drops in the bucket isn't a minor contribution to solving the problem." Let's talk about contributions and solutions in the time we have left. Donna wrote on our Facebook page, "I've been recycling for years. I only eat meat one day a week and buy clothes and other household items from resale shops. I also contribute to organizations that work to protect endangered species and wild places. I've had no children, and I believe that's the best thing I've done." Amy, population policy keeps coming up. Ma wrote on our Facebook page, "The report also highlighted the fact that we're overpopulating our planet. Short of population control, what can we do to correct that?" How much does population come up policy-wise?
Population control is a very controversial topic in the realm of climate change. I think many people would say, you know, one way to look at climate change is at the root of it, the more people you have, the more energy you consume and the more emissions there are. I think another way to look at it is that there's got to be a way to use energy in a cleaner way, so therefore you can continue to grow the population. I think I have friends and family who have talked about how they don't want to have kids because of climate change. I think, again, it goes back to this issue that we're all on the same planet, and these questions, whether or not we here in America have one or two children, I mean, the future and the decision about climate change really resides in Asia, where there's all of these booming populations that want energy and climate change, more energy, even amid action on climate change. So I think that's why it goes back to the leadership of America needs to be there in order to get these countries on board.
Professor Lovejoy and Susan, I'm not sure which of you is best to take this question, but Louisa asked, "What would be the alternatives to pesticides? Are pesticides really needed in our agriculture, or is that only for money-making purposes?" What would you say to Louisa? Professor?
So I don't think we can actually manage agriculture without some judicious biological controls of some sort or other. But better biological than chemical whenever given a choice.
What do you mean by biological controls? Give me an example.
So something that eats the pests, some other biological organism. Integrated pest management is the term. But back on population, you know, it's not just population, it's also consumption. And it's also very much about the empowerment of women. And when women are empowered, birth rates go down and the quality of life for their children goes up.
You're talking about in developing countries, yeah, in particular.
I know our time is short, but Amy, where do you see this conversation going from here, especially on a policy front?
I think under the Trump administration, we're going to continue to see dismissal of the issue. In fact, there could be more going in the opposite direction. The White House has been considering creating a panel that would question the scientific consensus on climate change. There's a big internal debate within the administration about whether or not that should go forward. So that's one thing I'll be watching.
Susan, I feel like for some of the people who say they've chosen not to have children, part of the subtext of that is, I don't want to bring children into a world that is doomed to burn. Are we going to make it?
So we are going to make it. I think all of us who work on this every day work with the hope and the trust that we will make it. One of the things that this report has really pointed out is the need not only to continue fighting climate change as we are, but to think about our natural systems and increase the amount of land and oceans that we have under protection. And so the other big thing that's out there in the international community is a push to protect at least 30% of our land and 30% of our oceans globally by 2030.
Professor, last word. Are we going to make it, do you think? Based on our current trajectory, are we going to make it?
If you look at the current numbers, no, but there's no reason they can't change. And both on climate and biodiversity protection and quality of life for people.
Thomas Lovejoy, biology professor at George Mason University and a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation. Professor Lovejoy, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz, the chief program officer at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And Amy Harder, who covers energy and climate for Axios. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Before we go, quick word about a new educational partnership. A lot of teachers tell us you use topics from 1A in the classroom. If you are a teacher who would like to use our content, we've partnered with ListenWise to provide free classroom materials based on listening comprehension for all ages. Go to ListenWise.com and search 1A. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.